This is Paul, and Michael was super flexible. I met Michael in Chino, and I promised him a slot, and I'm going to see, you know, what I can do with evenings, because evenings I can actually plan a little bit. And so just this afternoon, I said, can you go tonight? And he said, yes. So here we are, Michael.
Hello. This little corner.
At Chino, you said your back was hurting, and so you couldn't really fully enjoy it. He's in this room where he and his wife are super into board games, which is super interesting to me. And that is so cool. My wife and I like to go to open houses because my wife would like a nicer house than what we live in. So we often go into open houses, and we went into one open house and they just had a couple of walls of board games. And yes. We thought, oh,
yes,
that's because we love playing board games with our adult children. So
I love it. I love the imagination. I love the camaraderie. It's so much fun. And I spend a lot of time playing video games and very complex, competitive games, and nothing beats sitting across the table from someone's face engaging in like those moments when they hit and you're like, yes. We play a lot of co-op games where you have like a big bad or something horrible that you guys have to fight against.
Yeah.
And those games are just like, they're a hit every single time. And I've played at tournaments in video games. I could barely remember them. I remember winning like a game at a Shut Up and Sit Down in Canada. I have more memories of that one convention than I do of my entire career in gaming. It's just something about with people and faces and communing. It's super fun.
Yeah.
Super, super fun.
Well, let's start with you, Michael. I don't know, you know, it's your time. I don't know if you want to just start with yourself. They're, you know, my kind of usually what I run people through, or you know, where you grew up, what your life was like a kid, and then we can go from there.
So I was kind of pestering you to get on here because I have a very strange and unique story that inlays lots of all the themes that are going on in society right now and what's being discussed in this corner of the internet. And it's so much synchronicity, to use a Jungian term, that it blows my mind. So I really, my intention is I would like to tell you my story and then just run it through your Paul vision and see, and you ask me anything you want at any point.
All right, let's do it.
And just go. But so my story begins that I was raised in a small city outside of Los Angeles called Alhambra. And people in this area would probably know it, but I'm the youngest of four. I have a half sibling out there from my father, and our house situation was not the best. It wasn't. It's not like anything that you'd read extreme in a novel, but there was a lot of verbal psychological abuse. There was a lot of just complete chaotic emotions constantly going out all the time. And the reason why this is important is because my life is pretty much marred by what happened in this home and then where it took me. And it has to deal with God. And so, and I'm you know, okay, so my dad, we're all Hispanic. My name is Michael Collins, though, because my father wanted us to have white sounding names to make sure that we could get jobs and get interviews and things like that. And so we didn't learn Spanish, even though they knew Spanish. But it was, and my family's still around and such. I don't think they'll ever see this video, but I'm putting it out there anyways, just because I think it needs to be heard. And I've been a wanderer for so long, but a lot of essentially what it is that my father and my mother were both very abused as children growing up in their respective families. My father had a divorce when he was like 13. His father left. His mother raised him. She was very, we'll just say, very mean towards men. and he had two sisters, and she put a lot on him and a lot of pressure. My mother had a, this is funny. My mother's mother has 7 sisters and 2 brothers. And of those 7 sisters, one of them is the mother of Edward James Olmos. So it's a big family over there. But my mother, her mother was very, I mean, to this day, she's alive and she treats my mother like crap. And she's a mean, mean narcissist. She used to tell my mom she was stupid since she was a little kid. She would punish her, make her sit on her knees in the closet, hit her. And then she has 2 other siblings with 2 other men. So never was she really with. And then the last one she stayed with until he passed. But I only say all this just to kind of set you up that somehow but this woman and this guy had a kid when they were around 18 years old, and that was my older brother. And it was a very you know, they didn't move in with each other till my brother was already 8. So my brother was already had a lot of issues. He ended up becoming like a pirate musician, always, you know, he's accomplished quite a lot, but in his mind he there's a lot of self flagellation and just can't enjoy things about himself. It's really rough. I say all this because I'm in a spot right now where I don't talk to that brother and I don't talk to one of my sisters, and I can't, especially after I had kids. They're caught up in this toxic family dynamic that they treat me like utter crap. They hear nothing that I say. There's nothing that I can really do. And it was just something that I ended up escaping anyways. So when we were little, it was mostly okay. And then by the time that I got to 9 or 10 is when the divorce, the big D-Day happened. And then it was utter chaos. It was fist fights. Every other day, the cops were at our house once a week. My father was in and out of the house. My mother was in and out of the house. Eventually, she ended up leaving, and then my dad stayed. And then it was still just, you know, I mean, every you never knew. And my siblings are going through this too. It was mostly me and my 2 sisters. Me, I have a sister that's 2 older, and then 2 years older than her. My brother's 14 years older from me. So he was already, like, when I was 5, he was already 20. And so he was already out of the house at that time. And so me and my sisters were the real ones that were trapped in that house together. And, you know, they were going through a hard time. They had, you know, they're going through puberty and everything, and yelling and screaming and punching and hitting and verbal abuse and anything that would, I mean, anything could set anybody off. It was so bad that I remember just walking home from the 8th grade and just getting a couple blocks from my house and just wanting to vomit. And it was every time I was coming home, I would just get sick to my stomach. I just do not want to even, I would start trying to go to friends' houses and stay the night there. I was that kid, you know. However, saving grace for me was that my mother had insisted, because they didn't do it for my brother, but my mother insisted because when she was little, she had went to Catholic school for like 4 years. And she said it was the best time of her life ever. And so she insisted that me and my sisters went to Catholic school. And even though problems had already, because I was the youngest, the cracks were already showing when I was younger. I had moved from All Souls School in Alhambra to St. Thomas More, and then I went to St. Therese, and I had moved quite a bit between them. Despite all of that, the Bible and what I learned from Catholic school was the only thing that could explain what I was going through. And I never met a literary moment where where I saw myself in a book until the sixth grade when we read The Whipping Boy. And when I read, I was like, oh, well, that's me. Oh, and I just had this instant lightning connection. And reading the book, I was like, yeah, that's how I feel. Yeah, that's how that goes. And I had an immediate in connection. But that was the first time with a literary book. But the Bible for me, though, from the very beginning, it was just obvious. I didn't have a moment where it was like I chose to believe or not.
Yeah.
It just reflected reality. And it wasn't the fun parts of the Bible. If there are any.
You know, it's so funny because people want to sanitize the Bible often. And it's like, no, you don't want to do that.
No, the horrible stuff is what made me feel normal.
Yeah.
That's what made me feel like I had, the quest for a spiritual home.
Yeah.
That was what made me feel like I had a center.
Yeah.
And of course, you know, I'm a kid, so I don't have any language to put any of this to. All I can remember is that when I was 4, 3 years old, I can remember back, I have a couple things back at 3 and a little bit at 2, just visions, but they're almost like dreams. But I just remember being a kid and being outside and seeing the world and light and sound and everything. And it was perfect. And nothing was not perfect when I was in nature. And then when I'd go back into the home and with the family, it was chaos and insanity. And I always knew and felt really protective of that. I guess now I could call it innocence, but I don't know if it's innocence because it didn't feel innocent. It just felt real and it felt like true. Yeah. And so I always had that and I always buried that. And that was always something that I related to as my own connection to the world. And so anytime something bad happened or would go low enough to challenge me to reject that part, I would reject whatever it was that was challenging me and not that part. I would protect that tooth and nail. Mm-hmm. I just wouldn't. And I was always like that as a kid. The way I'm going to tell this story is a little, I'm trying to use language from then, because since my journey, I've upgraded language and I don't want to use that yet. Because I think that it's important to understand what I saw then, because then you'll understand the epiphany of when I ran into people with better language.
Yeah.
And language wasn't something in my house either. That was, my dad wasn't really that educated, nor my mother. You know, they weren't dumb people by any long shot. But it was very emotional and the language was not there. So the main thing that happened, if I was doing Jordan Peterson's breaking your life down into epochs, one of them was when the divorce happened and I was being taken out of St. Therese and being taken to public school for the first time. And this was right at the tail end of eighth grade. And so my parents were already divorced. My dad is in the house. There was a misunderstanding at school. One of the kids every time I switched to one of these schools, it was like I always had to try to integrate with the kids. And I just started like really integrating with my class. I'd been there since the sixth grade and we're now going to the eighth grade. And now they're really starting to accept me, the boys and the girls. And one of them, though, when I first was there was I won't use his name. We'll call him James. He was of Egyptian descent. And it was him, another guy, and myself. And we were kind of treated as outcasts immediately. So when I got there, it was like, you're an outcast because you're not one of the, they'd all been going to school since kindergarten.
Right.
And so that was fine. At that point, I was used to it, right? So I just did my cool guy thing and eventually like wormed my way in everyone's hearts. But one day I was walking and one of the kids was, they were picking on the Egyptian kid and they did a thing called what they would call a camel circle, where they would move around him and make fun of him and move the circle around him. It was really, kids can be vicious, especially in Catholic schools where fighting was like the, it was always about getting somebody right up to the point of throwing a punch and using subterfuge and manipulation to get them to that point, and then be like, see, look, he did it. And so they did that to him, and they're driving him nuts. And I was walking by, and I was doing my daily thing where I'd go and look at the San Gabriel Mountains and just stare at them through the fence and just do my Shawshank Redemption thing for them. and I got to the fence, and all I hear is Michael did it. And I'm like, Michael, I hear my name. And then I hear a bump, 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 bump behind me, and I turn around, bam, I get hit in the face by James. And I reflexively, because my dad's dad was a boxer, he was in the military growing up, and he boxed. He tried to make it as a boxer, and he won some small purses, but too much damage, and so he just did car repair for most of his life. But I'd go there every other summer, and he would teach me how to fight. And he taught me how to fight, and he would tell me, you know, put his hands on my fists and tell me that this is, you're a big person, you're a strong person, you practice restraint. This is for self-defense only. So I reflectively just turn and just, you know, James, and then beat him on the floor for one or two punches until the person came and grabbed us off. We go into the principal's office, and we explain, me and him talk. And I find out what's going on. He realizes that they duped him. So me and him are okay, because we were always mostly friends, me and him. And so we were like, okay, we tell the principal, and they wanted me gone out of this school for a different reason. And that the reason why I'm telling the story is for that reason, is that we'd have Sunday mass every Wednesday. And then we'd have the in-class version where we would discuss with the priests. And then we had Sunday mass as well. So you get twice the dosage. And I liked it, actually. And I wanted to be a priest when I was growing up, because I saw them as I mean, use a modern word now, but back then I thought of them as Jedi Knights, but now I see them as mystics, wise men, right? And I was always attracted to wise men. Who knew the answers and had composure and compassion. And I always knew like that, oh, that's a man. Okay, that's a man. That's what I want to be. I want to be a man. Well, I want to grow up to be a man. And so I would ask a lot of questions in that class. And I was a funny kid. And that was my self-defense, is I'd be really funny and make fun of things. But in those classes, I asked serious questions, but the kids thought I was making jokes because I was contradicting the priest and what they were saying. Like I was telling one, I remember one very clearly was about limbo and purgatory. And I had some Asian neighbors that moved in. If anyone's from South California, they'll know that Alhambra has one of the highest populations of Asian people in the entire United States. And they were Chinese, like straight from China. And I made friends with the boys there, and they taught me Magic the Gathering and stuff, and they were really cool, and I liked them a lot. And the priest was telling me that they're gonna burn in hell until they accept Christ, and I was like, so I was like, okay, but what if they're not bad people though? Like I'm like, what if they just never heard of Jesus, right? Wouldn't Jesus just like sit down and talk to them first? Like, does it have to go straight to hellfire? But that's how I thought as a kid. And they didn't like that. So when this event happened with James, they decided to kick me out of the school. And it was a no ands, ifs, or buts thing.
Wow.
They thought I was that much of a problem. And wow. this one priest in particular didn't like me. And this one other priest absolutely liked me and took me under his wing. And that was the younger one. The younger one liked me. So my dad comes to the school, and he's arguing with the principal, and they tell me to go wait in the church. So I wait in the church, and lo and behold, there's the young priest, right? And I'm sitting there looking. I'm assuming I'm looking pretty miserable. Yeah, sure. I don't think that I would be hiding that. And so he asked me what was wrong, and I just told him because I was just thinking about it. And it's the weirdest thing, you know. I've told this story. I only recently started, I would talk to this story through myself through the years, but I never told anybody. And only when the Chino estuary happened, that was the first time I really started opening up about any of this. And so I don't have words for this, but I knew that my life was falling apart. I knew that things were never going to be the same. Things were never going to go back to the way they were. And things were going to get really, really, really hard. I don't know how I knew that. I really don't. I just knew that I felt like the floor was being taken under out of my feet, and I was in free fall. And so the priest must have saw that. And so he came over and he asked me how I was doing. And I told him that I had already been thinking about it. And I told him, how do I leave the church? And I just said that flat out to him. How do I leave the church? And he goes, well, it doesn't work that way. You don't like leave the church. And I'm like, but I'm not going to be here. I'm not ever going to come back. So is there a way that I'm supposed to leave? Am I supposed to, is there like a ceremony that I'm supposed to do to leave the church? And he goes, well, you were baptized. And I go, yes. He's like, so you're going to always be with the church. And I go, so there's nothing I can just leave. And he goes, well, that's not the point. And I go, okay. And I just kind of walk him off, 'cause I don't want to hear him trying to help, even though I know he was.
Yeah.
And he goes, you know, wait, my son, like that. And I walk out the front doors of the church.
Yeah.
And I'm at the top of the church and steps, and ironically, it started raining. So I'm standing there and it's raining, and I'm just sitting there and I'm just going, I'm like on the verge of now I know what it's called. It's hyperventilating. I'm on the verge of hyperventilating, and I look up at the sky, and the clouds part for a second, and I can see the sun. And for some reason, my memory as being a kid has always been attached to the sun. Something about the sun and me it's always felt like truth, like real. I can never deny that. And so I looked up at the sun, and I don't know where this came from, but I said, whoever you are and whatever you are, I will find your name. And this after I said that, it stopped raining for a second, and then the clouds went back over and it rained again. And it wasn't that simple, but for the rest of my life, from that moment, anything that I did, whether it was work or surviving or sleeping behind dumpsters or just avoiding doing something horrible, that was always in the back of my mind, was that I have something to do. I have a charge to do. I had no idea what I was signing myself up for. I had no idea the gravity of those words. I'm laughing my butt off when I'm watching the Exodus series with Peterson, and they're going over and over about the name of God. And I'm just like, what did you do, Michael? Like, could you have asked for the hardest mission? But what it was a promise to myself that I'm going to get to the bottom of this.
Yeah.
Of whatever this is, yeah. Whatever this is, I'm going to get to the bottom of it for me.
Yeah.
And that literally saved my life. I can say without any arrogance, pure humility, and without any fog or deception, that had I not done that, I mean, I literally had friends at the same time who were going through divorces and things like that. Half of them are dead.
Yeah.
One of them gave himself essentially ALS from doing so much drugs. His nerves are permanently messed. I don't talk to any of them anymore. They all had to be left, because they just my friendships with them were always me holding on to this burden of Christ and them just finding some way to just drag you down to hell. And they were dead set on just aiming down. And I was surrounded by those types of people, and the people in my own family, save my one sister, they were all aiming down. And I'm happy to say that my mother, like 5 years ago, she just really turned a leaf in her grief and her suffering, and started seeing the right therapist and going to church. And me and her have a really good relationship now, because we can talk about this stuff.
Yeah.
And I can make her laugh about it too. Yeah. And, that's one of those epochs. The rest is pretty much just, I did IT. I did odd jobs. I got an IT. I got A+ and M+ certified. Everything I did was a means to survive.
Yeah.
But every free time that I had was dedicated to reading.
Hmm.
And it was because my freedom that I found was through literature, mostly nonfiction.
Hmm.
So anything to try to find. Okay, so it was like a series. What really happened was, right after that happened, where I made that declaration, a whole series of things happened immediately, where it was like, okay, everything you thought you knew about the world, you have to double check it. You have to decide whether this is useful or not, if it's good, if it's healthy. You gotta rebuild, I'll use a modern term, your axioms. I didn't have that term back then. I called it my art back then. I said that I was my own art. So I would have to redraw myself, repaint myself. But in the image of what is true. I never didn't think anything was not true. I knew from my whole life that there is a thing as true with a capital T, that it's just something, if we don't know it, it's something that it hasn't revealed itself, or we have not understood it, but it's there. And that all the things I saw in my life, and especially in my own family, was how well or how poorly someone adhered to truth to determine the quality of their existence. And I knew that leaning into truth can be brutal, and it could be really rough, but I would do that over deception no matter what. It was obvious to me that it may not serve you now, it may put you in a bad place here, it may not get you everything you want here, but when you get all the way down here, you will be thankful that you followed that pathway to truth, because it highlights everything, all the bad. You see how lacking you are, how much of you is fake. And I would go through all this later when I found Peterson.
Yeah, because you sound a lot like Peterson with that. I mean, yeah, that's basically exactly what he says.
That's why I knew he was the real deal when I found him on the internet a little bit before he blew up, was because I'm like, hey, this guy's talking about my life. he's just using different, I had my own language.
Yep.
You know,
yep.
I had a completely whole language. So I was just sitting there. I immediately bought Maps for Meaning.
Yeah.
That was really hard to read.
Yeah.
But and I was reading that one with Neumann's History of Consciousness at the same, that was easier to read than Peterson. But what Peterson gave me was a lot of good language. And that's what was nice, because he updated a lot of my words for some of this stuff.
Yep.
But I had known this stuff just from being honest with what I'm experiencing.
Yeah.
And just living very, I would not betray that trust.
Yeah.
I would not betray my vision.
Yeah.
Just under no circumstance.
Yeah. Now, when you got kicked out of Catholic school, did you continue to have a relationship with the church, or did that sort of go by the wayside?
No, never had a relationship with the church since.
Really?
No, I would every now and then stumble into a church via some person that I met at some point in my adventures.
Yeah.
And I always had a reverence. I didn't blame the church.
Yeah.
That's important to know. I never blamed the church.
Yeah.
I describe it like almost being in a cult. Like people, you're a kid. You know, you don't think people are going to understand. And when I would tell people about how my family was, they would think I'm lying. And these were people that I was hanging out with their kids and having dinner with them, and eventually got to a part where I opened up and told them about some of the abuse, and they would just be like, "Oh, you're lying." And I realized, but they would do it in a fun and like a haha way. And then it was, and I realized, oh, people, they don't, if they don't know, they don't know.
Yeah.
And they don't, they won't look, they won't see that. They just don't see that.
Yeah.
So I, I didn't have any interactions with the church. Ironically though, like I always saw myself as a Catholic. I always saw myself as that stuff was burned into my brain and especially the passion. And so I would always, you know, Peterson says it later about bearing your cross, but I knew what that was way before I ever heard of Peterson. And the way I would describe it was walking through a blizzard in the dark and having a little candle that was mine.
Yeah.
And it was my job to keep it okay.
Yeah.
And if I lost that, then I'd end up like all the other people around me that I saw just falling into the abyss. I knew that that was what was keeping me from falling into the abyss. So I protected it. So it's for me, God's been a very personal, like with a capital P, personal relationship.
Yeah.
That's part of why I'm here. Cause I'm like, I need friends. I've been going for a while without friends and without any comrades even.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it's like, there's only so much you can take on your back.
Yeah.
And now that I'm a father too, and, and the importance of that, and just the love that you get from a children and how much they teach you.
Yeah.
And like my kids just confirmed so much that what I did was right.
Yeah.
Because I knew from when I was very young that I wanted to be a father. And I've always wanted, I knew that I wanted a family. And what was strange was that when I was asking when I was rewriting my axioms, I was like, well, how do I find a guideline to keep me there? Like the Bible was still too, I was still too young. The Bible was just way over my head in a lot of things. Yeah. Like I'd hear the thing and it makes sense. And I'm like, you know, I hear these parables and stuff. I'm like, wow, you know, it blows my mind. It made sense. But I didn't sit there and read the Bible and have that kind of relationship with it.
Yeah.
So what I did was I just imagined that my future children were always standing next to me. And I would say, if my kids were standing right next to me, would I want them to see me doing this? And that was always at my lowest points. I would, you know, wake up from doing drugs or something, and I would see my kids sitting there watching me, and I would have to get out of here. So that would keep me safe.
Yeah.
But that was my baseline. Now that my kids are here and they're like so full of love and joy they teach me, you know.
Yeah.
I did everything. I think I did it right as far as purging what I thought a father was from my own father.
Yeah.
One of the, sorry, go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say that I've known people who have had, you know, really bad childhoods, you know, a lot of chaos, a lot of bad stuff in the home. And it's interesting where most of the people, if they've had a really bad childhood and they really want to, and they wind up becoming parents, you know, they really want to do better. Some of them really do better. Some of them, I mean, it's a strange thing, that experience just really cemented into them. I don't do this. I do this because I saw it.
Yeah.
Others of them, sometimes the good that they would do, they can't seem to do. And that's so hard for them because they watch themselves, you know, basically usually not at the same level of intensity or destruction, but it's so difficult. It's so difficult. And so it sounds like you've been blessed.
That's the way that I look at it. And that's the way that I've looked at it my entire life, is that I can't ask for the past to be undone, because if any, I don't know how it works, any part of that is removed, then who knows where I would have ended up.
Yeah.
that every lesson is valuable, and every choice was valuable. And I look at it like that, that I am absolutely blessed.
Yeah.
Because what you just described right now, that's my sister.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that's
yeah.
her with her kids. And she's doing the same mistakes, exact same. And I'm seeing the sadness in their eyes of her children. The same. I'm like, she thought that what I'm going to do is I'm going to have my own family and I'm going to do it better than my parents. And she didn't reflect on any of it. And so all she did was become the worst of both.
Yeah.
And she has a really good husband. She has really good kids. I mean, but they are, you can tell that they're very scared of her. They don't trust her. It was the same way with my father.
Yeah.
You know, he was scary. He's,
yeah.
What people don't realize when you come from a house like that, after about 18, I traveled a lot, and I lived in New York, I lived in New Jersey, I lived in Connecticut, I lived in parts of Canada illegally, I went to the Pacific Northwest, to Oklahoma and Texas. I just would go wherever the wind would take me.
Yeah.
And my goal was to just see how people live.
Yeah.
And to get a grasp of what this, my life, answering the question of what, to answer the question of what God's name was like, okay, well, if I have to answer what God's name was, I have to know what God is. And to know what God is, I have to know what the world is.
Yeah.
And if I have to know what the world is, then I need to know what world history is. And if I have to know what world history is, I have to know what a human is.
Yeah.
And if I want to be a father somewhere in that, then I have to find out what a good human is. So I had a lot of work ahead of me. And so I spent a lot of time reading history stuff. And I remember one of the biggest influences on me when I was 16 was Neil Postman's Amusing Ourselves to Death.
Yeah.
I read that. I was like, oh, this guy talks like very clean, very easy to understand, and he's speaking truth.
Yeah.
And I remember I was reading that in high school, and it was already the 2000s, early 2000s. I graduated 2002. I didn't technically graduate. I got a GED and quit early out of protest. But I showed them. I had the highest score in the Chino Unified district's history. They're like, I did it because a history teacher told me that I'd be nothing without a degree, without a high school education. I'm like, well, I'll show you, you know, stupid me, of course. But it was so avoidable. It was so dumb. But anyways, I when I read Neil Postman and Amusing Ourselves to Death, I was like, there's truth, because a lot of stuff happened right at that time. It was 9/11.
Yeah.
That freaked me the hell out. I know, you know, people talk about conspiracies and stuff. I will not be afraid to say that there was enough distrust in the narrative of what happened that day that at least merited an investigation.
Yeah.
And when I saw that, I can never, because this was really big for me, because one, it made me completely distrust my father, because his attitude to that was believe whatever CNN tells you. And I'm watching the buildings, I'm watching them go down in what looks like a controlled demolition that does not look like it's just falling apart. It's I'm trusting my eyes and what I see. And by the next morning, the American flags go up. Everybody is, we're going to war. No one's listening. And just the boots of war just come marching by. And I was just watching it happen in real time.
Yeah.
And anytime I would say anything, questioning anything, I'd get spit on, I'd get yelled at, and I realized at that moment my research changed, because up to that point I was still kind of looking at the Bible, looking at Judaism, looking at the Quran, looking in the religions, because I knew that. But at that point I was like, I'm going into American history now, because somebody, to me, can I cuss on here? Okay, I'm just gonna. I'm trying not to, but I'll say. But at that point, I realized that somebody far away can fuck with me and my family.
Yeah,
it was the first time I realized that somebody can put a lie inside inside my the seed of my into my coven and corrupt it. And that was like, I saw power and I saw fear and I saw the one ring of Sauron, and that scared the crap out of me, that you can project into these people's minds, the television, because I never trusted the television. I got one when I was 15 and I put it out of my room because it was, I couldn't understand why we're trusting a box that's telling us things.
Yeah.
And I didn't understand why I would subjugate my own experience to something that this box is telling me. Yeah. Like no amount of experts can make me untrust myself.
Yeah.
And so it was just bizarre that people would, but to the extent that people would allow it to think for them was what scared me. Yeah. Like everything, the way they formulated their experiences, their values, everything. And so television is what scared me. That's what led me to Neil Postman, yeah, abusing ourselves to death. And then eventually to Carol Quigley's, the where he goes over the whole history of the United States and all these different, I forgot the name of the book, it's upstairs. But I got into like the conspiratorial side of American history. And then I just kept going, back and back and back and back and back in history. And that's eventually what led me to Jung and in psychology. Because after going beyond history, I started to see a pattern of thought that was related to religion. And then I went all the way back to the Plato and Socrates and that time period, and then followed it back to see how it evolved to the present. And that's what led me to Jung, Neumann, Peterson, you see.
Okay.
So
so what do you want? What are you looking for? So now obviously your life is, I mean, you're sitting in the midst of a great game room. You have children, you have a family, you are, you know, you have achieved in many ways, and that achievement is something of a restoration, because it's a funny thing that when you were raised the way, you know, with all of the struggles you were, part of the drive to be a father and be a good father and give your children a good home. And of course, there's a strange irony in there, because the thing you want for your children is for them to never really experience or know what you went through. Yeah. But that innocence for them is also a naivete,
right,
that they, you know, in some ways they might be like those other kids. When you would explain to other kids, this is what your life is like, a kid is like, life isn't like that, because that's never been. So right. there's an interesting irony with these kinds of redemptions and transformations. But so now that you've achieved this, what do you want?
That's the thing, is, you know, there's always been a struggle in my mind from the pressure, the spiritual father that you see your parents as God, yeah, you know, yeah, and the pressure that your godfather puts on you. And there was a while, so about maybe 4 years ago, I hurt my back working out and doing weights incorrectly. I herniated a disc. But right at that moment, I had told myself, I was living in the Pacific Northwest. I had a really good job. My wife wanted to come back to be closer to family. And we decided, she was getting homesick, even though I loved it out there. But she was not like me. She stayed with her family. So it was perfect for me, but not for her. We talked about it. We agreed. We came back. And I thought, you know what? I'm going to go full throttle into Hollywood. I'm gonna just do what I can to make money in Hollywood. But what I always wanted to do was to write stories. I've always seen the world in story. I've always talked in story. I wonder if that comes across in the way that I talk to you, if it sounds.
You told your story well. You told your story well. And that's, I mean, not everybody can do that.
That, thank you. And I don't have someone to bounce it off, so that's why I asked naively. Because I want to tell stories, but I don't have anything to bounce it off to think if I'm good at it or not. And I say that because I started immediately landing roles in walk-on things. And I was in a workshop for comedy. And I went to this comedy workshop. And I'm answering your question. Went to this comedy workshop. And the first day there, they had us do some improv stuff. And there's some people in there that were actors that I even recognized from small shows and stuff. Yeah. And I stood up and I did my thing. And I had everybody rolling, everybody laughing. And I found out the next day that they all had me as the person to beat in the class. They're like, he's the best one. And I'm coming home from this thing after the second day. I'm having a great time. Paul, like, the most sickening lightning you can imagine. I hear the voice of my dad brutally tell me, you will not say anything about any of us. You will not tell anyone about who we are and what you will not share who you are and you're gonna fail and you're not gonna be this and such.
Yeah.
And it made me so sick. I had to pull over in a parking lot and just sit there. And I had thought at that point that I had already dealt with the majority of my demons. I've never ran away from a fight when it comes to my demons because that was between me and who is God.
Yeah.
But, and I thought I had done a really good job, but then I started to realize I never knew if I could do something like this. And I just got a lot of positive feedback. This is all new for me. Yeah. And then here came this horrible voice. And I sat there and I told myself, you know, it's not your father. Even your father today wouldn't tell you that.
Yeah.
He's not even the same person anymore.
Yeah.
But it didn't change the fact that it rattled me so much that I ended up dropping from the thing.
Oh.
Yeah.
And then that's too bad.
And then, like fate, my back broke like 2 weeks
later. Oh, no.
On my birthday.
Oh, no.
And so I've been living on my back on the floor for like 4 years. Actually, I have surgery this November.
Oh, I hope the surgery helps.
I hope so, too. And then COVID happened.
Yeah,
and I was already living at home. So for me, it was like, it's like nothing different.
Everybody actually gets to live like me now.
Everyone gets to live like me. I had really not a hard time at all transitioning to that since I was already in the midst of it. But yeah, you know, I can't help but think that these are necessary though.
Yeah.
And so where I am now, what I want to answer your question, for the longest, it was to be useful. To be as useful as possible to the best type of people.
Yeah.
And that's where I'm at, is I don't have a people.
Yeah.
And so where do I put all this wisdom and knowledge? Like, I could make somebody feel like they have the power to face, you know, Satan himself.
Yeah.
But I don't have anyone to give that to right now, other than my kids, but they're too young.
Yeah.
And it's like, it feels like a shame for me to hoard that with my family when I came from a hoarding cult family.
Yeah.
And it's like, that's what I remembered, was slowly just not hanging out with neighbors and not hanging out with cousins and not hanging out with people till it was just our unit and my dad's craziness and just that's all it was. That's all it was like. It was like being in a cult.
Yeah.
When you see those cult people escape.
Do you live in the Chino area?
I bounce back. My mom lives over there.
Okay.
With one of my sisters. Okay. And I was there for a while, like for 2 years in high school. Went to Don Lugo. And that was that period. But then I hadn't been back there since.
Okay.
But I'm over in the Torrance area now.
Okay.
And I really like being close to the water. That really helps my soul a lot. So anytime I try to live anywhere, I try to be close to a beach. Or even a lake would be really nice. But like, water makes me feel safe. I don't know why, even though a lot of danger comes from water, but
no, but water, no, you're right. I mean, water is just there's something weird about water where it's something therapeutic about it. There really is. I, you know, when my wife and I go on vacation, we'll often just go someplace where there's water, and we will spend days just looking at water.
Yeah, and I love just staring at water and thinking and feeling, and the wind, all that is just fantastic. Right now, what I'm doing to, you know, plans change because of my back and everything. So this was a major reason why I want to talk to you. I'll just really quickly sum up. I got to Peterson through the archaeological, sociological route. I didn't actually get to Peterson from the bills. That it was coincidence. It literally happened like a month after I was already pretty deep into his lectures on his class. I got there purely from Jung and Neumann.
Yeah.
And going, dude, this guy is like basically wrote his book about me. Like, I really want to go tell him, like, hey, I'm the living incarnation of all the things you said not to do with your kids.
Yeah.
Like, I really like to talk to you. And then he blew up.
Yeah.
And then, and I told you this at Chino, but I want to tell you again, because it means a lot to me to tell you this. That's when I started getting, about 4 or 5 years ago, is when I started getting the recommendations for your channel. And for the first time, because if you remember me saying I wanted to be a priest when I was young, a lot of the priests that I met, and even especially pastors in the Chino area and such, they were very like, you know, like sporting event pastors. They have
what's a sporting event pastor?
Like, I got a band behind me and a big screen TV, and I'm like, yeah, and that's why you need God in your life. Yes. Yes, you can have that power. You can take that love and send it right up to God. You know, and I'm like, okay, that doesn't, this isn't for me. I got it. I was looking for depth, you know, and what's crazy is I never knew anything about Orthodox churches or anything like that. They just never, just never hit. And then I saw your channel, and who knows, maybe I just had really bad luck running into like decent pastors or priests. But when I saw your channel and I heard you use those very early ones where you're talking about dissecting Peterson's stuff, I'm just like, oh, this guy's legit. He's the real deal. And what it was I, like, it came very clear to me that you cared about people. That was number one. It had nothing to do with Peterson, had nothing to do with the content you were talking about. It was like, oh, this guy cares about people. Like, actually, like, is walking the walk that the priest would tell me about, to live like Christ and to care about the people at the bottom. And I couldn't find those people. So I was always looking for one to be a role model for me. So then I just said, well, screw it. I'll just figure it out myself. So I'll just be that person. I was always telling myself, be the person you wish you could have ran into growing up.
Yeah.
So I'm always that guy that's helping everybody whenever I run into them, and I'll disappear to the smoke and you never heard my name or anything.
Yeah.
And I get off on that a little bit. I'm just like, ha, mysterious. But not always. That's actually pretty lonely. And when I saw you, I was like, wow, as corny as it sounds, I'm going to say it anyways, cause I don't betray the truth. I found, in a way, a spiritual home on your channel.
Mm-hmm.
And was not interested. I'm going to be real honest. I'm not interested really in all the other people who listen to the channel and the groups that are forming. I got into the Bridges of Meaning Discord, and I just could not figure out for the life of me to penetrate that ecosystem at all. I'm like, I don't have the time. I don't have the patience. I'm on a very specific mission, and I don't know. I'm sure they're wonderful people and that we would all get along, but you were the reason why I stuck around, and you're the reason why that I pay attention to all these other things from your channel. Every person you've recommended since, Tom Holland, I read Dominion. That was hard. but just because it's a lot, man.
It's a lot. It's a lot of books.
He writes so damn well, dude.
Yeah, he does.
He is really such a good writer. Yeah. He is amazing at telling these stories, but it's a lot. It is a lot of history. Yeah. But anything you've mentioned different people and stuff, the people that come on your radar, I kind of just treated it like almost like this is my garden at the church is your channel. Because I am involved with the church, my wife's church. They're Lutherans.
Good.
And I'm not that involved. Like they've been there for, 38 years. Laura grew up with my wife. She grew up with they've raised her, we've raised their kids now.
Yeah.
But there's now a generation of kids that I've helped, and now they're all going to college.
Yeah.
And I get that feeling there. I still don't feel quite like I'm at home there though.
Okay.
But I got a taste of it. Yeah. And that's what I get with your channel, and specifically with you. So
thank you.
I appreciate your will and your honesty and your submission to God is real. And it's like, that's legit. I'm like, I could feel that. I'm like, no, this guy, cause it's not easy. I just know from personal experience to be that honest with what God is, and to also, cause to be honest with it is to challenge it constantly. And I just don't see people put in that kind of work. Yeah. I see people, what I say is they stop. They get to a certain point and then they stop. And they're like, we're going to build my house here. And it's like, I've never been comfortable with stopping. I feel like it's a continuous journey. And I just see that with you. I'm like, man, this guy reads a lot. He makes all these videos. He watches. I'm like, and at your age, like, so you're like an inspiration to me. I'm like,
not that old.
I know. But everyone
I'm still doing this at 85, then you can say that.
Most people I've met at your age though, there's nothing like that that they're that passionate about. And so I'm not trying to kiss butt or anything, but it was like I was like, oh, he's the kind of guy that I was looking for growing up. Like who actually cares. And that's not to say that other people don't. I do know they exist. Yeah, I just didn't meet them.
Yeah. And it's hard. There's a lot of people, and people are pulled a lot of different ways. And but thank you for that. That means a lot to me. Your passion for honesty, that is really important in this world right now. I mean, we're not always right, but at least if we can be honest, that helps. And Peterson says it well. I mean, Peterson really does articulate that quite well when he talks about it's and you articulate. I mean, you sounded just like him when you go further down the line. And at least I think about that sometimes when I make videos, because it's like, am I gonna say this? Because there's a lot of reasons to not say this, but this is what I think. And I know that there's always some group that has a party line on something that if you don't adhere to it, they're going to knock you, and they're going to, take shots at you and all of that. And that's, I understand that, but to just at least try to say, hey, I might be right. I might be wrong, but this is what I see. This is what I see. And I think if in fact we do that with each other, then we will all in fact be better. And if we can learn to do that with each other, if we can listen to someone at least share honestly what they think, then maybe we can stop wasting a lot of time playing a lot of counterproductive games. So,
but what I could say is, anyone who's listening to this, when I hear Jordan Peterson describe the horrors of the gulags and people lying to themselves, that's why I say that I'm blessed. I'm glad that I was in a toxic family, because I got no one could ever take away to be ridiculed. The truth was not welcome in my home. And anytime the truth was said, you were sometimes literally beat.
Yeah.
And
yeah, that's so, isn't that, you're exactly right.
And that's why I'm the way I am.
Tyrannical societies and tyrannical homes, they're the same thing in some ways.
And for that reason, I will not yield to deception. I don't care how stupid I look. I don't care how dumb I look. You can throw cabbage at me. You can crucify me. I will not yield. I am that guy that if everyone is going nuts, I will say the truth. I've done it in people's houses. I remember one time, and I really do take to heart the whole thing about, you know, don't pray in public and don't brag. I don't know anyone. I don't talk to anybody. But I'll tell you this story as an example because it really put me in a weird position at my job. But I was at a personal party with some coworkers, and this girl that's coming, who was apparently has a degree in something or something or other, and she knows one of the girls there who also has a degree in psychology, and she's coming over, and she's married to this guy who apparently has like ADHD or something like that. But I don't know what the details is, but all I know is what I saw is that they come over to this barbecue and she is just beating this guy down in front of everybody, and no one is saying anything, and I'm just standing there just shocked. I'm like looking, I'm just like, are you seeing this? And they just kind of smile at me like I'm like, you are seeing it. You're choosing not to say anything because it would be inconveniencing for you or what have you. And we sit down at the dinner table, and she lets into him one more time. And I go, hey, I'm like, can you leave him the fuck alone? You think he's had enough today already? All right. He's literally crying. Are any of you people going to look at this guy? He's literally crying at a dinner table and you're all laughing. You call yourselves decent human beings?
Wow.
What the hell is... And I led into them. Man. And I just left. Man. And I ended up talking to the friend who was the psychologist girl. Me and her had a good relationship. And I said, honestly, what did you see? And she said, I honestly didn't see it.
Really?
And she was someone, I wouldn't say that she was really in the hardcore feminist camp.
Yeah, yeah.
There was definitely a feminist slant. Yeah. She was raised by a single mother who was also that way.
Yeah.
I don't know if that had something to do with it. I'm guessing because I don't know. But she was honest when she said she didn't see it.
Wow.
And I was just godsmacked. But I've had many situations like that in my life, and I don't let them pass.
Yeah.
I can't stand seeing somebody get trampled on.
Well, and again, I mean, partly it's a weird thing how in some ways an abusive childhood it disables a lot of people, but it also enables some people. And it's a funny dynamic, and it's always, you can never know who this evil is going to bless and who this evil is going to curse. Yeah. You just can't tell beforehand. You see it play out and it's like, wow.
The closest I've seen as an explanation is there's some people who do their videos and talks about different types of personalities and families and narcissistic toxic family situations. Like, I went down a rabbit hole to try to understand myself, like a child post-traumatic stress syndrome, like, but you know, this is all through the lens of Western psychology, and the closest thing that I've heard, and it's not even a real explanation, so I don't think they really know, but they were saying that some kids just can see truth.
Yeah.
And they just see right through it.
Yeah.
From the day they were born.
Yeah.
And that's the closest thing I've been able to find as a way to apply to myself.
Yeah.
And I just know that if I betray that, I betray my entire existence. Yeah. And that's something I'm not willing to do.
Yeah.
I don't want to betray my existence. It's all for me in a lot of ways, all I ever had.
Yeah. Yeah.
So
yeah.
As the walls were even more narrowed in my house, it was the only thing that separated me from the chaos was that I could see it. And that if I gave into it, it was like I couldn't even choose to give into it, though.
Right.
So that's the thing.
Right.
It would be like a fish trying to fly. So yeah. I couldn't foresee that. Mm-hmm. So I just endured the pain. Yeah. So that was my thing, is I'm really good at enduring pain for long periods of time.
That's actually a huge, it's one of the key relational skills is actually pain endurance, because a lot of the ways that people hurt one another is because instead of enduring the pain, they basically reflect the pain back at someone else. They receive it and they push it over.
That's my
I'm
sister.
Feeling pain, so I'm going to hurt you. And why are you hurting me? I didn't do anything to you. No, it's because I can. And of course, they don't even think it through. They just do it.
That's 100% my sister. Like, you couldn't pick a perfect example, a mirror example of one little section in one family than me and my sister at this point. Yeah. She will go off on anybody. She will tell them the most horrible things and then apologize the next second and then act like she never did it.
Yeah.
And I know it comes from exactly what you said, the inability to endure that pain because they're so frightened and because they're so fragile and because of those things. So it makes it really difficult to figure out what the right move is to do with her, because I want her kids to spend time with my kids.
Yeah.
And I know that I can help her children, her sons constantly, because they never played board games or anything like that.
Yeah, I'm sure.
And he's come here one time and he was like, can I live here? He's like, this place is amazing. Yeah. And he's really smart. Like, he's so smart. And my sister thinks, she's like, I don't want you to stay with your uncle. There's something wrong with him. He's weird. She calls me weird because I don't adhere to the toxicity.
Yeah.
I was gonna tell you though, because there was like some new stuff. And this is what I just been dying to tell you. I was pushing to get to on here. So I feel like part of that quest has paid off, because now I know kind of what I've been looking for has been the best high-res frame that I can find to explain what is going on in society at this time. And it didn't all click and it didn't all hit until finally I read The Master and His Emissary by Ian McGilchrist.
Yeah.
Have you read that book yet?
No, I've read some of it. I haven't finished it.
I think he figured it out.
Yeah.
I just, when I finished reading it, and now I have volume one and two of his.
This is his next big book.
They are very hard books. Yeah. He is very good, though. He is really good at saying something very complicated and then kind of reiterating it, and then complicated, and then reiterating it.
Yeah.
But everyone, I think, for all the people that were at the Chino Estuary and what we're all trying to figure out, Verveke's work, Peugeot, I put in a special camp with you, which are those who know the pattern from God and are trying to maintain that branch and morph it with whatever the hell's going on out here, versus those who are outside the branch and are wandering.
Yeah.
I think McGilchrist has, did I say it right?
McGilchrist.
I always add a Gila in there because I think that's every Irish name. my friends called me out on that like three times. She's like, you keep calling him McGilchrist. I'm like, I think he did it. I think the left and right hemisphere explains, as far as I can tell, because for me, I'm not a researcher person, but what I have is a matrix of patterns, and an amazing bullshit detector of those patterns. Like, that was my first thing, was escaping the prison of bullshit.
Yeah.
So I would say my talents are, I'm an escape artist. I escaped the mind, the hell out of my own head and shackles that way. And I think that's helped me when I've gone on this adventure to filter out bullshit and be able to frog hop to different subjects without having to become a master of that subject. I've definitely embraced the jack of all trades and for expediency and to get, because my goal has been, I got to get as far out to the fringe as possible to find out what is the largest frame or container to explain what it is that a man is at this day and age, to answer the question of who is God. Yeah. And what I found, because, you know, of course, it's the 13,000 year destruction that happened. So I have a different perspective of where we are as people, that we are actually a traumatized, collective traumatized civilization healing on the same time rediscovering ancient lost knowledge. But McGilchrist has, I think, completely provided the best possible frame. Because as far as I can tell, the left and right hemisphere schema and what he's put forth maps all the way up and all the way down and all the way left and all the way right to all the problems that are happening in the West and in the rest of the world, as far as being able to see the contrast in non-Western civilizations. It also explains that as well. And I think part of the reason why this overuse of the left hemisphere occurred was because of the trauma occurred 13,000 years ago, a need for rapid growth and rapid rebuilding, but it's gone out of control. And I would implore you to read his book and see what you see when you see that, because I think it also completely accounts for what the Bible's talking about, is literally how to manage your hemispheres and in story form, you know, and it's taking, it's brilliant. I mean, of course the Bible's brilliant because it's taking these very unique and extremes. It's to map out this type of territory of the human existence to the largest it can possibly do. And as far as I can tell, the supremacy of the left hemisphere overriding the master, which is the right hemisphere, that every story in the Bible is the moral of the story is through God, the reconnecting to the right hemisphere and a reframing for the left hemisphere to put it back in its cage, that this process is necessary, you know, just like to escape my prison was not to become more connected to people, which would have been right hemisphere. It was to become more ruthless in my left hemisphere to map my way out of it. I did have to use intuition and such to do that, but it was like that had to be finely tuned as a sword first. And then once I broke through, then it was all about putting that sword back in its sheath. Okay. And it was all about forgiveness and letting things reappear to you and reemerge to you in a correct, healthy way. And this going in and going out process is exactly what McGilchrist describes in his books. It's exactly what Verveke's work is all about. Verveke is looking at it the exact same thing as McGilchrist, except Verveke where McGilchrist is coming up with the board game themes and the broad mechanics, Verveke is writing the rule book.
Interesting.
So he's in the nitty gritty, you know, doing all this little stuff.
McGilchrist is someone that's just always out there. And I, you know, I always think, yeah, I should watch more of his stuff and I should finish that book and probably read it again as a whole, maybe now in puppy prison. I have more time to read now. I just can't schedule anything because I never know what schedule the little dog is going to have. So it's
An interview recently. I'm not sure how recent it is now. I think it's at least a week or so.
He's on a lot. You can find a lot of videos
with him. He talked recently, and I thought what really touched me about him was it hit real home with me, because my wife's asked me like what's motivated me. And I've always said that I just love this world. I've always loved this world. And I just don't want to lose that connection I told you about.
Yeah.
I don't want to lose that. And I don't want to see this world fail and fall into darkness.
Yeah.
McGilchrist gave the same answer as to what motivated him to write his book. And it damn near made me cry.
Wow.
And this has been his entire life is studying this hemisphere thing. Yeah. So there's no one comes close to him as far as researching this.
Interesting.
He is the only guy who has gone this far into this one subject and has dedicated his whole life and has put it into these two books, the Master Emissary and the two volumes of The Matter of Things. And according to him, he's done writing. He's done, he's like, he may write some fun stuff, but his mission is over as far as he's concerned.
So. Well, Michael, it's been a joy talking to you. And I can't wait to share this with others. And
I'm scared, but whatever.
we don't have to. I could keep behind the paywall if you want you were pretty transparent about your family.
I think you should. I think you should, because I think that's always served me well not to hide.
Well, given what you said about truth, it seems right. So
it never, like Peterson says, it never stops scaring me.
Okay. Well, thank you, Michael.
I'm just more scared of the other things.
It was a pleasure hearing your story, and I wish you well in terms of your board games and your family, and hopefully that surgery will help your back so you can get out and do a little bit more, and maybe some of those other dreams that you had that got deferred, maybe some of those will come true. So
thank you.
All right. Take care, Michael. Have a good evening.
You too.
Bye-bye.